Welcome to Neonatology Now, the official podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Here at Neonatology Now, we are shining a light on the real-world experiences of world-renowned experts in perinatal medicine. Together, we will learn from top medical doctors, researchers, and opinion leaders to better understand how we can improve professional neonatal care in Europe and beyond. It's not just about the science. It's about the stories and experiences shaping this critical field of medicine. And now, without further ado, let me introduce you to your host, a seasoned neonatologist and our guide through these fascinating conversations, Professor Mario Rüdiger. Mario, take it away.
Welcome to a new episode of Neonatology Now, the podcast of the European School of Neonatology, where we explore the most pressing topics in neonatology. Today's topic, parental nutrition. I'm Professor Rüdiger, and my guest for today is Professor Niklas Embleton from the University of Newcastle upon Tyne. So today's episode is dedicated to neonatal specialists with strong interest in neonatal nutrition. And therefore, I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Niklas Embleton, who has recently published an in-depth review on parental nutrition in preterm infants. Niklas, welcome to Neonatology Now.
Thank you very much, Mario. Lovely to meet you.
Yes, so first, let me introduce you. So you are a distinguished consultant, neonatal pediatrician, and honorary clinical professor of neonatal medicine based in Newcastle upon Tyne. And you qualified actually in medicine from Newcastle University, and you have worked as a full-time consultant at the Royal Victoria Infirmary's NICU for over two decades now. And Furthermore, you led a program of research focused on neonatal nutrition, gut function, growth outcomes, and long-term health. And interestingly, I read that your doctoral work was already on protein requirements in preterm infants, so you are a real long-term specialist in this field. And finally, you've been in this for a long time, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it feels a bit frightening to think that I did my doctoral thesis almost 30 years ago now, but yeah, it's a long time.
Okay, but it's a lot of expertise you have. Yeah. And so you're also a founding member and the chair of the UK Neonatal Nutrition Network, and you also have collaborated internationally with key societies like ESPGAN, WHO, and so on. So it's real pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. And after my short introduction, just one question. What did I forget that is still of importance to you?
Oh, well, I mean, neonatal nutrition was my introduction to neonatal research, and that's where I focused most of my efforts. But I think in the last 15 years, I've done a lot of work with parents whose babies died. So I've had projects running with parents of who had twin babies on the NICU, and one baby died and one baby survived. So we've done a lot of qualitative studies around that, and we've now branched out into doing more work looking at how women choose to manage their lactation after the baby dies. And we've got projects on sort of palliative care and managing uncertainty. So I kind of realized as my career went on in neonatology how important it was to really understand what it felt like to be a parent involved in the NICU. You know, for us, it feels like home. We spend so much of our lives there. It feels like a very normal thing to be doing, to looking after sick babies. And sometimes it's important that we stand back and actually see what the real impact is on the family and what the impact is after the babies go home, or the lifelong impact if the baby dies.
Mm-hmm. That's a very nice segue to my next question, because I always ask for a special anecdote in your professional career you would like to share with our listeners.
Yeah, well, I guess my anecdote would be that I'm still in contact with a woman who's now 30 years old. In fact, she'll be 30 this year. She was born on my birthday in 1996. As a 23-week twin, and her twin sister died at a few hours of age. And she was very sick. She was on high frequency, and we often thought she wouldn't survive. I cared for her when I was a fellow. And then she did get better and went home. And for some reason, I kept in contact with her mum for many years, and she would send me kind of birthday cards and photos of her growing up. And she did great as a 23-weeker. She got straight A's at school, decided she wanted to be a nurse, qualified in nursing, and then wanted to be a neonatal nurse and came back to work on my unit as
Really?
one of my senior neonatal nurses. So we have photos of standing next to the incubator where I used to intubate her and put drips in her 30 years ago, which is slightly mind-blowing.
That's a nice story, and yeah, it's an interesting story to see how everything is progressing, how we are getting
Absolutely.
older, but how time passes by. So actually, we will also talk about how parental nutrition has evolved over time. And so you already spoke about the 1960s. And actually, parental nutrition has been part of neonatal care since about the 1980s. And looking back, in your opinion, what were the key milestones with regard to parental nutrition that really changed outcomes for preterm infants?
I mean, you're right. I mean, the first reports of parental nutrition for babies appeared in the very late 1960s. It was used sporadically in the 1970s, mainly for term-born babies with surgical conditions, gastroschisis, babies who couldn't tolerate milk. And it was really in the 80s that it started to become more routinely used in preterm babies. But even, when I was doing my residency in 91, 92, we were using parenteral nutrition, but we weren't using it routinely. I think it was considered to be a bit expensive, almost a bit experimental still in the 90s. But then, during my period of training in the 90s, it became a routine part of care. And I think when we were first using it in the 90s, there were all these kind of concerns, was it going to be harmful when you're giving too many amino acids? So people were a bit cautious. People started it really, late, very slowly. Took you kind of maybe week, 10 days to get up to the full amount. So we weren't using it optimally because we just didn't really have the data. But then, we now have a lot of observational studies showing us that, there does seem to be a relationship between getting better nutrition in the early days and better brain outcomes. So now we see it just as a normal routine part of neonatal care. We don't really stop to think. The baby gets born, gets admitted to the NICU, and you just put the baby on PN and take it from there. So it's become very normal and very routine these days.
So was there any, or at least one innovation that made the biggest difference concerning parenteral nutrition?
Well, I mean, first of all, people had to get the right kind of composition in the bags. What balance of amino acids particularly did you want? I mean, as we have essential amino acids. These are amino acids that the human can't make, so they have to be provided in the diet. And then we have non-essential amino acids, which the body can produce, but you need a nitrogen source to make them. So the first sort of question was, well, how many essential amino acids and how many non-essential amino acids do you need? What's the right balance? What's the amount? And when you ask that question, you then start to think, well, what's the gold standard? I mean, what is the reference? And if you're a 25-week baby, should we be aiming to replicate the amino acid profile of a 25-week fetus or a breastfed baby? And of course, if you have a breastfed baby, a healthy baby, well, you're thinking about a term baby. But I mean, what's the evidence that we should have an amino acid profile the same as a term baby when you're still a 25-week fetus and all your organs are developing? So I think we're still uncertain what the balance should be. And therefore, you will see that there are different amino acid solutions available, commercially available, and they're kind of based on different kind of references, a kind of combination almost of fetal and breast milk. But the honest answer is we don't really know what the optimal balance should be.
I mean, that's the main question in neonatology. What about the preterm infant? Is it a fetus which is outside of the body, or is it a newborn? You should treat like a newborn, yeah. But looking from the other perspective, are there any lessons that we might have lost sight of today?
Well, I think one of the things that's really changed that we learned was actually, it isn't just thinking about the kind of nutrients in the bag. I mean, of course, we're very interested in the amino acids and everything that else goes in the bag, but it's how we actually use it on the neonatal unit. I mean, how do we use this? What is a life-saving intervention? How do we use it safely? So, the lessons really for me are not just about what's in the bag, but all of the kind of clinical governance aspects that go along. I mean, how do you actually, as a hospital, procure your PN? How does it get delivered? Who looks after it in the pharmacy? How do you move it to the neonatal unit? Where do you store your emergency bags? All of these kind of delivery process governance bits, I think, are so important. And these are the bits that, as a neonatologist, you don't think about. You just go to the fridge and put a bag out, or the pharmacy comes along with a bag. But those are the really important aspects. We get very interested in, well, should I give a little bit more of this amino acid or another? But ultimately, you're using something that is very dangerous. You get the wrong solution, you get a contaminated solution, you get sepsis. I mean, you can have the most perfect solution in the world, but if you can't get all these governance aspects sorted out, then So I think what we've learned is really all of these other steps. But as I say, as a kind of fellow on a neonatal unit, you don't perhaps think about all of these other aspects before you connect the baby to your line.
It's a good point. But initially, parenteral nutrition was about survival. So everything we did was about survival. Nowadays, it's more about optimization of growth, body composition, long-term outcomes. So how would you describe this shift in goals?
Well, I mean, we've all seen, haven't we, in the last 30 years, how it's become routine for babies at 24, 25 weeks to survive. I mean, we would now be quite disappointed if a 25-weeker didn't survive. We would feel we've messed up somewhere. So the fact that, survival is now expected at these very small, immature kind of stages means we have focused much more on the longer term aspects of neonatology and the quality. And of course, nutrition is there for every baby. I mean, people love their ventilators and their different types of controls on the ventilators, and they love the PDA and echoes. And I mean, of course, all those things are important, but without food, you're dead. So every baby needs good nutrition, and that's not just, as you say, just to kind of keep them alive, but it is really to think about the long term. But I think sometimes people don't step back to realize what an incredible thing neonatology is doing. You think about a baby at 500 grams. Well, that baby as a fetus is almost 90% water. So we're looking after 50 grams of dry tissue, most of which is protein. There's a little bit of calcium, magnesium, phosphate, tiny amounts of fat in your cell membranes in your brain, but no fat stores. We're looking after 50 grams of tissue. And a baby at 25 weeks, we know they lose about 1 gram a kilo a day of protein just because of normal protein turnover. All of the cells, all of your body organs are constantly turning over. The protein in your body is constantly turning over. And in all of that turnover, you get a bit of wastage. So every day you're leaking 1 gram a kilo of protein in your urine and stool a little bit. So really what we've learned is that, when you give PN, you're not just giving the amount that the baby needs to grow. You need to give the extra amount to compensate for all of
Leakage.
the wastage and leakage, so to speak. So I think it's this kind of realization, actually, we're right on the cusp of survival here. Yeah, we should be focused on survival, but we're really thinking, I mean, how do we actually give these babies, how do you give 50 grams, an organism of 50 grams dry thing, how do you give them the right balance of stuff to keep them alive and keep them growing? I mean, it is remarkable that so many babies do so well when, in fact, we don't really know that much about what's happening inside the body.
Yeah, I think that's the difference to the ventilator. In a ventilator, you see oxygenation, you see your carbon dioxide, you do something and you see the changes very quickly. But in nutrition, it's always either you have the short-term goal of some growth targets, Or you have the long-term goal in your mind, and then you have to think about neurodevelopmental outcome, about long-term metabolic problems. So that's very different, very difficult to target, isn't it?
Well, it's very difficult to target, but we need to kind of encourage people to think about it, because every second of every day, you have a monitor that tells you about the cardiovascular system, the respiratory system. You know, your oxygen saturation drops down into the 80s and you're tweaking it back up a little bit, and you're fine-tuning the cardiorespiratory system every second of every hour from the minute that baby's born. Whereas often what I see with nutrition is, all right, well, we'll connect up the PN and there's this bag of PN hanging there. Or let's go back to the oxygen and the blood gases. You know, people realize that you know, the nutrition is so vital to your survival, but we don't have a monitor. I often kind of imagine a monitor that would monitor your nutritional status. It would tell you, oh, your energy status is too low, or your protein status, or you've not got enough vitamins. I mean, imagine we had some sort of monitor that we can clip onto your hand that told you about what was happening. I think we would do a better job, but we don't have anything like that. We look at the baby. The baby looks the same today as he did tomorrow. The next day, he kind of looks the same. The weight's maybe not changing. You're not really tuned in to the complexity of nutrition, because you have all of these other kind of alarms and noises and pretty pictures on echo scans and pulmonary graphics. What do we have that gives us feedback on the respiratory system? Not much, really. And I think that's why we don't do a good job, because we're not forced to think about it.
So you have actually focused very much on amino acid requirements in your paper. Why is it so difficult to define the right amino acid intake for preterm infants?
It's so difficult to know really what you should be doing, because we can't measure what's the normal situation in the fetus. I mean, vast amounts of amino acids are transported across the placenta in fetal life, and presumably nature evolution has fine-tuned those, you know, amino acid transport, fine-tuned it to grow a fetus. Now, we know that more amino acids go across the placenta than the baby really needs, so there's a kind of surplus. But, you know, when you're in utero, you're connected to your mum's metabolism and kidneys, and you can get rid of all of your ureas and everything because your mum's kidneys doing it. We know that, you know, ex utero, renal function takes days, weeks to mature. So if you just tipped in the same amount of protein, amino acids that you get in utero, that possibly could be harmful. And all of those amino acids need to be turned into tissue, into lean tissue, you know, muscles and liver and brain. You know, we have to be careful. We obviously want to give the babies enough amino acids that they grow similar to a fetus. But at the same time, we can't simply replicate what comes across the placenta because that isn't what we're dealing with. And we're in a kind of higher oxygen environment. You know, the fetus is relatively anaerobic. So just replicating what happens in utero doesn't make any sense because we're not in an anaerobic environment. So there are so many different layers to it. I don't think we really know, and I don't think we'll ever really know what's the optimal thing. All we can do is to say, well, look, this is the best we can think of at the present. This works pretty well, and then build on it from there. But I don't think we will ever really know what is the optimal amino acid solution for a very preemie baby.
So you think it's more a problem of measurement or a problem of interpretation of the results?
Yeah, it's well, the management is very challenging because how would we take measures from a fetus? I mean, how do you actually sample what's in a fetus in the first place? We can't really do that. And then, you know, ex utero, well, of course, we can do plasma amino acid profiles, but these change hour to hour. You know, there's different sort of techniques, different laboratories, you know, and even if we could measure these things, really the question we want to ask is, well, are we giving enough for the brain to grow? And of course we want to think about body composition and long-term outcomes around obesity and growth, but really what distinguishes humans from all the other animals is our brain. I mean, that's what allows us to control the planet. And this is why you and me are talking over the internet thousands of miles apart. So it's the brain we really want to think about. And so, of course, we do a lot of studies measuring weight gain and growth and things, but we need to know and think about what's the best way of nourishing the brain. We know that lots of the babies born very prematurely may have differences in metabolism in later life. I mean, they may be more prone to obesity or cardiovascular problems. I mean, all of that is important. But really, those problems happen in your 40s and 50s. Really, really what we're thinking about is how do we optimize brain growth? How do we make sure we're providing enough nutrients that we're not limiting brain growth? And that's a very difficult thing, because what do you measure in the brain at a few days or a few weeks of age? So we can't really get any reasonable measurements until the babies are like 2 years old.
So you were already talking about introduction of amino acids very early now after the first day of life. So it was a big discussion 20 years ago when to start and so on. So how confident are we that early high amino acid intake is really beneficial nowadays?
I think we're reasonably confident that you can start amino acids and in the first hour, that you can start amino acids without causing a problem. By that I mean you can start amino acids early without causing abnormal plasma amino acid profiles and those aspects. So I think kind of biochemically, we know we can start early. What we don't know is how quickly we should take the baby from starting the PN solution up to the full amount of PN solution. We don't really know what the full amount of PN solution should be. We know that the amount of amino acids as protein, let's just pretend it's protein, but we know the amount of protein that we would give him in PN probably will be a bit less than with enteral nutrition, because in enteral nutrition, a lot of your amino acids take place in intestinal turnover, intestinal metabolism, and you have losses in the stool. You don't really have that in PN. So we can guess that the amount of protein you need in PN is a bit less than with enteral nutrition. But we don't really know how quickly we should get up to the full amount. Now, we're kind of at the minute kind of guessing that the full amount probably is somewhere between about 3 and 3.5 grams per kilo a day. We think for enteral, it probably closer to 4 grams, maybe in your tiny babies a little bit higher than that. So we're probably aiming, if you're only going to give the baby PN, somewhere around about 3, 3.5 grams. But what we don't know is, should you get there sort of straight away? Now, there have been one or two studies where they start on 3 grams on day zero and they show no benefit. And even there's some signal potentially of a little bit of harm, which isn't surprising. I mean, like, the babies have to upregulate all of their enzyme systems. I mean, the baby isn't born ready to tolerate full nutrition the minute it's born. So to me, it makes kind of perfect sense that we don't start at the full amount. But then, my interpretation of studies is that if you get to the full amount within 3 days or so, you're probably doing okay. So I don't think we need to push it too fast. I think we need to make sure the babies are stable and healthy before we aim for the top amount. In the last few years, there's been a lot of interest in, can you overload nutrition? Can you kind of give too much nutrition? I definitely think you can, because all of the proteins you give to a baby have to be broken down and either accreted into muscles and liver or disposed of and oxidized. It's a very complicated system. And I think we should be concerned that if you try and overload, particularly amino acids, before a baby's ready, you might cause harm, or if the baby is unwell in some other way. So I think there's reasonable evidence now to assume that if a baby is very catabolic and sick, for example, sepsis, neck, whatever, you need to be careful about not overloading amino acids. So my own thinking is, like, in the first 24, 48 hours, I don't really know what this baby's going to be like. I mean, do I know that he hasn't got sepsis? Do I know he's not going to be very unstable, needing lots of inotropes? If he's septic and sick, I probably want to give him a bit less. So, my argument in the first 24 hours is, yeah, just go slowly. Probably half the full amount to start with looks a good starting point. somewhere around about 1.5, 2 grams, and then see what he's like 24 hours later. If he looks fine, edge him up a bit more the next day, edge him up a little bit more. That to me feels fine. I don't worry that for what that means is for 2 or 3 days, you're not getting what you would need as a fetus to grow, but I'm not that bothered about it because that's just 2 or 3 days. You've got another 2 or 3 months to really nourish that baby. So I think the first bit is getting something in there, stopping the baby becoming too catabolic because you're just not giving the baby anything at all. So you need to give enough to switch off the natural kind of catabolic losses, I suppose. But do we know the right amount to start in the first 24, 48 hours? No, I don't think we know that yet.
So what about infants with growth retardation? Do they need more? Or should we be more careful?
They have more kind of biochemical stresses. I don't think there's any evidence that they should have more than the other babies. So I don't feed my babies any different, whether they're IUGR or AGA. But we know that these babies, many of the IUGR babies come out and behave physiologically as if they've been malnourished or starved. So they have features of what was described in adults of kind of refeeding syndrome. And I was a bit skeptical about this. I mean, when people first talked about this kind of 20 years ago, I thought, no, I'm not really quite sure, but I'm absolutely convinced in it with studies we've seen in the last 10, 20 years that the IUGR babies do behave as if they're malnourished, and they seem to kind of almost consume these amino acids more voraciously than other babies. And what you can then see is as all of the amino acids enter the cells, they kind of drag the electrolytes and the phosphates with them. And we see features very similar to what you saw in adults who were malnourished and rapidly fed. And you can see this in anorexics. You've got to be very careful when you refeed an anorexic to feed them slowly. And the kind of concept is that you need to repair the cellular machinery before it can then do its job of growing. You need to kind of set all of your enzymes and your pumps and everything up to be. They need to be nourished before they can do the job. So it doesn't mean that we should necessarily feed IUGR babies more slowly. We just need to probably watch them more carefully. And what we see now that we've become more comfortable that the amino acid solutions we're using now seem to result in kind of reasonably normal plasma amino acid profiles. So we've kind of edged up on the amount of amino acids we give the babies in the last 20 years, but in doing that, we've recognized that more of these babies become hypophosphatemic because the phosphate is dragged along. When we first made the PN solutions 20, 30 years ago, we assumed that the kind of ratio of calcium to phosphate would be similar to what you need in enteral nutrition. You need more calcium than phosphate, about 1.5 to 1 on a molar basis. So that's how the PN solutions were formulated. But that meant that there probably wasn't enough phosphate. So now we see that, on a molar basis, calcium phosphate ratios in PN are probably close to 1 to 1. That's probably gives you the better profile. So with an IUGR babies, it's not necessarily that you should be giving them more or less amino acids, but you need to watch them more carefully. You need to be aware that they might need more phosphate in the early days, might need more potassium in the first few days. I don't tend to give them any more potassium because it tends to sort itself out reasonably well. But we do plan to give more phosphate to these babies in the first few days than we would have in the past.
So, is there any suggestion concerning blood checks for phosphate, calcium, and so on?
I mean, one of the problems is that the blood gas machines that we use, and let's in these very small babies, we might be doing blood gases 3 or 4 times a day. Most of them had an electrode for calcium, so we got their calcium levels back. But none of those machines measure phosphate. So we literally had no idea what was happening with
That's a
phosphate.
point, yeah.
So until you actually order a phosphate, you don't know what's going on. What you see with calcium is that calcium levels naturally dip a little bit in the first 24, 48 hours, and then they normally recover. Babies do obviously get some calcium in their PN. But even if the calcium's a little bit on the low side, I tend to ignore it. Calcium's very irritant, corrosive to veins, so you get some horrible burns with calcium extravasation. So even if I see calcium a little bit low, I don't get that excited. But the problem with phosphate is that unless you choose to measure it, you don't know what it is. So we never measured it until the babies were like in their second week of life, and then everybody thought, oh, we better do a kind of bone profile. And then you measure it, and the phosphate often then is a bit low. So we've started to measure the phosphates earlier and earlier. And now I would strongly recommend that if you're looking after 24, 25 weakers, particularly if they're IUGR, you should probably be measuring a phosphate in the first 2 or 3 days. And you might be surprised quite how low it goes. I've always been a practical, pragmatic sort of person. I've always believed, treat the baby, not the number. But when I started seeing these phosphates, they were really very low indeed. And there's numerous papers on it. And, I thought, well, what is it that phosphate does in the body? Well, of course, like phosphate is part of ATP, the intracellular energy source. Like if you don't give everyone else phosphate, well, it makes sense. You might be making enough energy, cellular energy. And what you see in England, we have lots of lovely fields and we have sheep in the fields. And in springtime, you see all these lovely lambs jumping around. And in the middle of the field, there's a big white block called salt lick. And the lambs lick this to get their salt, they get their sodium, and they get their phosphate with it. And if you don't give them this, they fall over because their muscles are so weak. And the same thing will happen in your preemie babies. If you don't give them enough phosphate, their muscles are weak. And then maybe it's not surprising that they don't manage to breathe off the ventilator when you put them on CPAP. Their muscles are just too weak. So I am sure that low phosphates have been an important issue that we just basically didn't recognize. So certainly these very small babies, I would recommend measuring a phosphate on probably day 3, and then based on that, either treat the baby or if not, measure it again 2 or 3 days later. I would definitely watch it. I do think it's an important issue that we didn't recognize 10, 20 years ago.
That's interesting. I've never thought about the phosphate for energy. But let's talk about just a bit about the lipids. And the so in the past, lipids has been mainly based on soybean, and now it's more a multi-component formulation. So what does evidence actually support at this point?
What the evidence supports is that we do not know what we're doing, right? We're in a bit of a mess, if I'm honest. Go back 20 years and we just had Intralipid, which was soybean oil, which had very low levels of N3, but probably too much N6, too much arachidonic acid, too much linoleic acid. And that gave you a very abnormal profile, and it didn't kind of look right. You thought, well, this can't be right for a newborn brain. They're going to need more DHA and more N3. So, many of us then have switched to using combination intravenous lipid emulsions like SMOF, which has kind of olive oil and fish oil and fungal oil, I think. And this has more DHA. And I think we all thought that was a good idea. I think we all thought, oh yeah, this is makes total logical sense, give more of the N3 stuff. And so we all of us have switched pretty much to using SMOF routinely instead of soybean oil. But then when you look at the biochemical profile of these babies on SMOF in the first few days, it's almost more abnormal than the soybean oil. And basically, the important issue is not simply the amount of N3, which is DHA or N6 arachidonic acid. It's not simply the amount you're giving, but it's also the ratio. Because when you give the precursor essential fatty acids. So your precursor essential fatty acids, your linoleic and your alpha linolenic. Okay, so linoleic goes down the N6 pathway, alpha linolenic goes down the N3 1. So you give these precursor essential fatty acids, and then you have enzymes that desaturate. I make these fatty acids longer to turn into arachidonic acid and DHA. And we don't need the names of any of these enzymes, but that's basically the mechanism. Give the essential fatty acids, stretch them out to make these important fatty acids. But the same enzymes work on both the N3 and the N6 pathway. So if you give the wrong balance, you give too much N6, you're kind of, all your enzymes are busy elongating those ones. They're not making enough of the N3 ones. So it's not just the amount, it's the balance. I thought 10 years ago that SMOF would be the right thing to give in the first few days of life. I'm not so sure I know what I'm talking about anymore. I'm pretty sure nobody, honestly, really understands it. I mean, I've read extensively, and it's so difficult to know what we should be doing. I'm not suggesting that anybody stop what they're doing, but I would caution that we don't yet know what is the right combination of fatty acids in early life. And let's remember, none of these intravenous lipid emulsions were designed for babies. It was certainly not premature babies. You know, we don't use enough of this. The companies are not really that interested in us, to be honest. They make their money selling it to adults. So we're using lipid emulsions that were designed for adults, and we're expecting that this is going to give you the right combination of these, you know, essential fats and long chain fats in a 25-week fetus. I mean, so it would be wonderful if there was more work to kind of, you know, design a better fatty acid emulsion. All I can tell you at the minute is every fatty acid emulsion gives you an abnormal profile. We think that these abnormalities may be linked to more inflammatory disease. There's data to show that these the more abnormal your profile, the higher rates of BPD. So we could be making things worse. There's even some data to show that these may relate to higher rates of NEC. So as I say, without knowing what the right thing to do is, I don't know what the right thing to do is, quite honestly. I think we should all be cautious that we do need to do much more work on this to make sure that we're not causing more harm. And maybe, you know, ploughing in with lots of fatty acids in the first 24, 48 hours, maybe that's not the right thing to do. We need some. Yeah. We need some, but just, you know, just thinking that this is it's just a bit of intravenous fat, let's just chuck it in there. I don't think we can be absolutely sure we're doing the right thing at this point in time.
It's interesting. That was my first research topic in neonatology, impact of fatty acids on BPD development.
Right.
That was interesting.
Yeah.
So,
well, we still don't know the answer.
But we agree that the best thing will be to switch to enteral nutrition as quick as possible, or to achieve enteral nutrition. So now is the question, what is as quick as possible, and are there any caveats we have to keep in mind when switching from parental to enteral nutrition?
Well, there are different kind of philosophical approaches. My philosophical approach is to keep the practice, the protocol, as simple as possible, because if I make it simple, then everybody will follow it. So I try not to make it too complicated. I try and encourage people to really listen to the nurse about whether the baby is tolerating milk. But all the data that I've seen suggests that babies can tolerate enteral milk much earlier than we ever thought possible. And we start all our babies now on buccal colostrum from the minute they're born. I think that's a great thing to do. We haven't got massive RCTs, but it seems to me like a no-brainer. The mums love it. The babies seem to tolerate it well. And I think you can, you know, you can start to increase fees as the mother naturally produces more milk. I mean, milk doesn't come in the first 1 or 2 days, so you're only giving tiny drops. But I think that, you know, for babies, you know, most babies can tolerate milk pretty early on. So we start all our babies at sort of like increasing the milk from about day two, day three onwards. We know from the SIF trial that there doesn't seem to be a big difference if you go a bit more slowly or a bit faster. You know, the SIF trial compared 18 to 30 mils a kilo a day of milk. And We didn't see any differences in rates of neck or sepsis between those two kind of groups of babies. But remember, in that trial, you only recruit the more healthy babies. So the very sick babies, you don't tend to, recruit as much. So whether we should, have different feeding regimes for different levels of sickness. Again, as I say, I tend just to be guided by the nurses because they're the ones who are there at the bedside and, can assess how the baby's doing. But I leave the PN running mil for mil. So as I go up with my enteral milk, I just go down mil for mil with the PN. That seems to naturally make a good transition. I tend not to fortify milk until the baby's on full feeds. Runs kind of against what we wrote in the ESPN guideline. In the ESPN guideline, people say, well, start the fortification the first, once you got to kind of 50 to 100. And that seems to work. My kind of reticent for doing that is when you add in the fortifier, you increase the nutrient density, gastric emptying slows down, you have bigger aspirates. The nurses then feel the baby's not tolerating the milk, and then you don't increase the milk. And then when you don't increase the milk, you're then not giving as much of the bio-nutrients from the mum, from the mum's milk. So my focus has always been on maximizing the amount of mum's milk I get into the baby. So personally, I prefer to feed a bit faster without fortifying it, get to full feeds a bit more quickly, and then fortify the baby rather than fortifying it, which I agree will give you a bit more protein and energy, but probably you then reach full feeds a bit later. And really, my thinking is about kind of gut health and gut function, avoiding NEC, keeping the baby healthy, buying nutrients to grow the brain. So I do something a little bit different to what we kind of recommend in Espigan, as I say, which is I would go a bit more quickly and fortify a bit later. Whereas other people would tend to sort of fortify it earlier, then you're meeting your macronutrients, but maybe then you don't increase the milk quite as quickly. And then you don't get quite as much of the bio-nutrients in.
That's a very good argument because I have the same approach, but I didn't have a good argument. So I'm very much relieved by this one. So, yeah,
Well,
that's good.
what we know is, like, of course, there is a relationship between the amount of macronutrients you get and growth and brain outcome. That's true. But the other thing we know is the more mum's milk you get, the better your outcome. So, for me, always. It's what can I do to get more of mum's milk into the baby? Maybe it's not quite true with donor milk. Maybe I would do something different if the baby was just on donor milk. But we know that fresh breast milk, and when I say fresh, I mean really fresh. Like, if you can get it still warm, before it's even been in the fridge, and this is stuffed full of beneficial bionutrients, stem cells. All of these cellular components are probably really beneficial. That's really good for your baby. So I would rather get that into the baby as quickly as possible, even if that means I'm not quite meeting the macronutrients that other people would get. I'm convinced that it's breast milk, that mother's breast milk that makes the difference. So I want to get as much of that in as quickly as possible. Then I'll think about the macronutrients a little bit later.
Now I will do it with much more confidence. Thank you. So just one final question. You were already talking about clinical trials. What would be your optimal clinical trial if you can design one on parental nutrition?
Well, I think, for me, there are two really big things. I mean, I get we don't honestly, we haven't sorted out the amino acids perfectly, but I don't see a big problem here. I don't see us going back and doing more studies of should we give a bit more or a bit less protein in the first few days. I don't think that's going to make any difference. I think the two big areas for me are the fatty acids and the energy and hyperglycemia. From the fatty acid thing, we really need kind of almost, we're probably not going to get new fatty acid emulsions, but I think we should be prepared to go back and ask ourselves the question, is it better just to leave the baby on intralipid in the first week rather than going straight in with SMOF? I think that would be a great trial with kind of biochemical outcomes, probably. Let's just see, can we get the biochemistry a bit more normal with what we have available? That would be one thing. I think the other big question is, What do we do with glucose? I mean, all of these 24, 25 weekers, particularly the IGR ones, often run a high glucose. Pretty common for us to be using insulin now. And we don't know, should we really be plowing on with the high energy intakes and shoving it in backed up by insulin, or should we back off on the energy intake? So I would be very interested still in a very kind of pragmatic trial where one arm was a kind of high nutrient arm, go for, lots of energy, lots of insulin, promoting kind of growth, brain growth that way. And the other is a more gentle one where if the baby's hypoglycemic, you back off a little bit and you try and avoid using insulin. I mean, insulin logically kind of makes sense, but actually, you're forcing this kind of very immature metabolism to do something it may not want to do. So I still think that a trial of, I don't want to use the word aggressive, but I'm going to have to use it. But a trial of kind of aggressive PN versus very gentle PN, and seeing what that does to the baby, because I still don't think we really know when you should be using insulin and what level of glucose.
That's always important in neonatology. Not everything what makes sense is really beneficial. So it was an
Exactly.
oxygen story and so on. So Niklas, that was a very interesting talk. And so tomorrow I will look at the baby and think about 50 gram of protein, not about 500 grams. So just at the end of our talk, a final question. What is your recommendation or advice to young clinicians or scientists who are just starting their career?
Do something you enjoy. I mean, do something that fascinates you. Don't do something because it happens to be the hot topic, or you think this is the thing that's going to give you your Nobel Prize or impress your boss or whatever. Like, do something you find really interesting, because if you find it interesting, you keep reading about it, you think about it, oh, I can do this. Like, be driven by your passion rather than, my brain says, well, I should do this because there's a, of course you have to be pragmatic. I mean, there's lots of things I'd love to do that I'm never going to get funded, so waste of time. So you do have to be pragmatic, but I would, like, if you really love echoes and PDAs, go and do that. If you love brains, go do brains. If you love nutrition, go do nutrition. Do something you really enjoy, because that
Because you
just
spend
makes
a
it
lot of
so,
time, yeah.
just spend, you're going to spend a lot of time doing it, and it's just more interesting to talk about and read widely. Don't get stuck in neonatal literature. We learn so much from other branches of medicine, even people who aren't medical. I learn a lot about baby loss just by speaking to social scientists. I never thought I'd be interested in that. So open your mind, look outside the NICU, speak to other people. This gives you ideas how to do your career better, maybe how to do your research better. But ultimately, if you want to do research, choose something that is just really fascinating to you.
So, I think we have a topic for next year or over next year talking about these loss. But for now, thank you very much. It was
You're
very
welcome.
interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, lovely to meet you.
That was it again. Neonatology Now, the podcast of the European School of Neonatology. Mario Rüdiger on the mic, and my guest for today was Niklas Embleton. If you do have any questions or comments, do not hesitate to contact us. Thank you for listening.